the Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellett.
And welcome in. This is the Battleground State Report. Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, Doug Kellett here with you to break down the news of the week and how it may play in the political arena. As always, go to BattlegroundStateNews.com. That's BattlegroundStateNews.com on the web, Battleground State News on Facebook, and tune in each weekend here as we'll break down the latest stories in the week that may have an impact on the 2020 election in those key 17 battleground states that will dictate the electoral votes that elect or don't elect somebody president. Somebody posted a great meme this week, by the way, that said January 21st, 2018 or 2019, the annual recognition of the 2 years since Hillary Clinton was not elected president of the United States.
I love that meme. That's great. And by the way, Steve, you mentioned that. Why are we doing this Battleground State Report? It's actually very important to get at the state level in these 17 key battleground states. Why do they matter? Well, we know in 2020, in the presidential election, 20 states are going to be red states, no matter who the candidate is. 13 states are going to be blue states, no matter who the candidate is. You know, California is going to be blue. New York's going to be blue. But the states that are going to determine who the next president is, there are 17 battleground states who, one degree or another, could go either Republican or Democrat. And just for the list, we're going to look at what's going on in those 17 states, not all each time, but, you know, we'll hit the highlights of them. And those 17 states, the battleground states, are Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado in the West, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania in the Midwest. In New England, it's Maine and New Hampshire, and in the South, Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida.
And the bottom line is that the local actions in those states will dictate what happens in those states. What was it? Tip O'Neill once said that all politics is local. And that's part of what we try to do here with the Battleground State Report each weekend. Doug, as we look at the events of this week, the chaos, the divisiveness, and the complicity of the mainstream media to literally lie their way into the political process, the propaganda's been there. But we've seen two examples just in the last week of the BuzzFeed stories that Michael Cohen was going to testify that Trump told him to lie and there were documents to back it up. That story from BuzzFeed was so far out of whack that Bob Mueller, the special prosecutor, felt compelled to issue a statement to say, not so fast, my friends. That's not true. It is remarkable that they would respond, but again showed how far afield that story that then rushed through the mainstream media like a wildfire with them taking that story that, again, Bob Mueller noted was just wrong, and then turning it into a, if true, and then they would run off on, you know, 20-minute diatribes on, it means that Trump's going to be indicted, he'll be in jail by Monday. And then you follow that up with what we saw at the Lincoln Memorial with these kids from Covington Catholic High School just sitting there waiting for the bus after the life march, the pro-life march. You see these kids, they're there, some of them are wearing their MAGA hats, and they're being 17, 16-year-old high school boys. You know, they start doing their high school chants, CHS is the best, CHS is the best. And apparently that triggered the black Hebrew Israelites who were there, five of them protesting and screaming the most vile things at these guys. And then some Native American group that was also there choosing to protest on that day because, well, there were TV cameras there, decided to aggressively approach these boys banging their drums. And then one gets about 2 inches from the face of one of the kids, captured on video, and it proves that these smirking teenagers were the most vile, deplorable display of American racism in history until the rest of the story was told, and it turns out that the Nathan Phillips, Native American fake Vietnam vet veteran, was the one that aggressively approached them, pounded the drum, lied about it. And Doug, I've told folks, thank God there was a video. Because if we'd been depending on what the kids said and what these adults were saying, they would have been crucified and there would have been no way they could have ever gotten the truth or the credibility of what happened out. Thank goodness there was a video. But even with that video, the mainstream media has continued to attack and assault these kids and use it for their political agenda. This week alone showed that the media has absolutely no credibility.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things on the Covington kids. First of all, they were at a pro-life rally, so that immediately puts them at odds with most of the mainstream media, right? And then they had Make America Great Again hats on, and so it sort of follows the meme that they've created that anyone that's wearing one of these red hats must be a racist out there. And then there's whatever altercation that was said to have occurred, right?
When I watch the University of Alabama playing football and see all those people in red, I automatically leap to that same conclusion, Doc.
Well, do they have Make America Great Again on the helmet? I better check. But I think that's part of it. Then, of course, the BuzzFeed thing. I mean, they're still standing by their story, even though it appears to be bogus, right? But what I'm trying to figure out is what value is it about being wrong, whether it's the coverage of the Covington Catholic kids, from a media perspective anyway, which has always been my business, is if eventually you're going to be proven out wrong, what good is it putting out a story? No matter what you think about Donald Trump and how damaging it might be in the short term to Donald Trump, eventually the truth is going to come out. So what value is there?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the other thing, too, related to that is there's a question. The left in these battleground states has really jumped on the false information that has been disproven and kind of, I think, hurt their causes. For instance, in Colorado, there was a teacher who, quote, doxed, that is, told the personal information about a student at Covington Catholic. Turns out, Doug, they doxed the wrong kid. I don't think that helps their cause of the left in Colorado. What do you think?
No, if you're going to do it, you might as well at least get the person right. If you're going to, smear them and ruin their reputation, you ought to get the right person. Sure. How did that happen?
The media also did a story claiming that a gay kid was denied being able to speak as valedictorian at Covington Catholic High School. Turns out it was another Catholic high school, not Covington. So again, the media keeps stepping in it. And dare I remind you, Covington is right on the border of Ohio and Cincinnati. So it does have a direct impact also in that battleground state. We'll talk more about it as the battleground state news continues in a moment.
Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellen.
Sorry, I'm distracted. I'm over here playing air guitar with our comeback music. one of the things as we talk about the battleground state effect of some of these news stories, and I think this Covington case is a prime example. Covington, Kentucky, and we've had all the news, national news media that really don't know much about flyover country. If you're in New York, if you're in San Francisco, in the media, and in Washington, D.C. Oh, Covington, Kentucky, and they have this vision that it's probably, in Appalachia, and they're, after they get home from working in the coal mines, they go to their Catholic school and start flashing white supremacy signals. Covington is literally right across the river. It is basically a suburb of Cincinnati, Ohio. So this is a story that not only is I think, having weight in the battleground states because it's just so aggressively and ridiculously wrong to mistreat these kids and lie about the story. And again, the fact that this Vietnam vet, Nathan Phillips, it now comes out that they were trying to portray him as some sort of a hero and how bad the kids were for demeaning and disrespecting this old Indian Vietnam veteran, this war hero. Turns out, he wasn't a hero at all.
Stolen valor.
Didn't even go to Vietnam.
And he has, despite all the media assists that the mainstream media, at NBC Savannah Guthrie tried to help him out here. He said, having claimed, "You've never claimed you've been a Vietnam vet," she said in an interview just this past week. Well, earlier in the month, he, in fact, there's a video that surfaced. He did claim that he was a Vietnam vet. So he's a liar. Stolen valor. He lied about his service in Vietnam. He also lied about the incident, which, as you mentioned, Steve, the videotape points out. You made another very good point in an earlier piece you did when you talked about the Christian and Catholic vote, particularly in the Midwest battleground states, being so important for Trump's victory in 2016. Now, here's kids from a Catholic school literally, you know, across the river, across the Ohio River from the big battleground state of Ohio, how are all these false charges against Catholics playing out among Catholic voters in Ohio?
And again, this agenda, anti-Catholic agenda, let's attack these kids agenda, may play well in San Francisco, in New York City. I don't think it's playing well in the battleground states, particularly these states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, that have large Catholic populations that are the swing vote in those states, that in the last election, just 170,000 votes in those four states were the difference in about 45 electoral votes swinging for Clinton or for Trump. Those same electoral votes are going to be critical. Those same Catholic votes are going to be critical. And yet over the last several weeks, we've seen the Democrats launching vicious attacks on Catholics, criticizing the Catholic organization that's akin to the Rotary or Kiwanis, the Knights of Columbus, attacking judges who are being confirmed for being too Catholic. You have now this attack on these Catholic school kids in Covington, Kentucky. And to make it worse, Doug, one of the visuals of those attacking these school kids is a hijab-wearing Muslim radical anti-Israel member of Congress, Ilhan Omar. I mean, just the visuals and optics of that are not going to help Democrats win Catholic votes in these key battleground states.
No, as a matter of fact, I talked for I don't know how long, how many years, but the Catholic vote in the Midwest to me has always been sort of an untapped resource that would fit well in the Republican Party. They were the Reagan Democrats. I mean, that helped Ronald Reagan and George Bush win his first term. And the people, you know, people who are strong in their faith, they take it seriously. And I don't think the media, I don't think in many cases, Democrats, not saying they don't have their own religious faith, but I think they don't take a lot of this as seriously, and people are being ridiculed about it. You know, we go back to the Covington kids. They were there for a March for Life rally because of the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And then and that in itself, sure, it's a divisive issue to a lot of people, but they're tired of being ridiculed about being pro-life. And a lot of Catholics, it's a mantra of theirs. And so, yeah, I mean, I do. I think it's an untapped resource. I think it played very well for President Trump when he ran for election the first time. Hillary Clinton has no relation to that group, right? A lot of Democrats have no relation to the group, and I think people are tired of being ridiculed for their faith.
Well, and then just to add icing on top of that very well-baked and covered cake, this week the Democrats in New York embrace a new pro-abortion policy that allows them to kill unborn babies to the moment of birth. And it's not just how bad that policy is in terms of pushing back people of faith, people who believe that protecting unborn lives is important. It is the celebration. You had one of the Twin Towers light up their tower in pink to celebrate this new baby killing law that they're clapping and cheering the right to kill babies who are one moment from being born and maybe even after partial birth. And there is no legitimate medical justification to terminate a pregnancy in this last couple of weeks, couple of months of pregnancy. And it's the cheering over it from the left that shows their disconnect from people of faith and, well, mainstream America.
No, I totally agree. I think also, too, you know, the fact that the media really doesn't understand why people have that position of life that they do. They don't understand it. They think it's all about somehow hanging up the rights of women or somehow oppressing women when it has nothing to do about that. These people are serious about what they think is a human life that, that should be saved. And you look at the Roe v. Wade decision. I mean, that's based on 1973 sort of medical technology, right? We've had a lot of advances since then to be able to look into the womb and see something that maybe back in 1973 they couldn't see.
They do surgery inside the womb to save the lives of these unborn children. I think Ronald Reagan, I think it was the one that said it best, that he finds it interesting that those who are most supportive of abortion have already been born.
Yeah,
good. You have to interview anyone that was happy or not happy that their mother did not have an abortion,
and,
right?
And the feminist angle always shocks me is that you do understand that half of the aborted babies are women, right? They are unborn baby girls. So when you're making this push that it's in the interest of women, well, I don't know, killing half of the babies that happen to be women might not be a great policy for women.
Yeah, well said, really. I mean, it's a divisive issue. I get it. But, and sure, maybe you can have that debate about when life begins, whether at conception and all of that. But still, it's a serious issue for people. And I think they're tired of being ridiculed about it.
So as we talk about this, it appears to me that most of these recent national issues that have come up this week in the battleground states, because the left nationally, but in particularly even in these battleground states, because they're overplaying their hand dramatically, that it's probably not helping the potential Democratic presidential candidate, whoever that may be, in 2020, and for the most part, probably helping President Trump. Is that how you see it, Steve?
Yeah, and I think it's the optics again of who is the spokesperson or the spokespeople for that leftist agenda. Again, when you have a hijab-wearing Muslim from Minnesota attacking young Catholic boys who didn't do anything
but also putting out false tweets,
right?
Making false claims that were clearly false about their conduct to such an extent that the attorney for these Covington Catholic boys have told her, you know, either retract that or we're going to sue you. And she has deleted the tweets, which apparently—
She didn't retract or apologize. She just deleted her tweet.
But apparently our Battleground State news managing editor, Anthony Gutkowski, spoke with the attorney, and he said that was satisfactory to them.
If you just delete your tweet, no harm, no foul. I think our friend Tammy Bruce writes for the Washington Examiner, is a frequent commentator on Fox News and others. She has a great piece that she put up Friday that points out that the real reason Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to allow President Trump to do his State of the Union is not just because she doesn't want Trump to speak to America. That's a big part of it. But she also doesn't want to showcase the out-of-control, crazy Democratic caucus freshman class of Rashida M.F. Tlaiba, who was dancing on election night with her Palestinian flag, not an American flag.
From the battleground state of Michigan.
You have Ilhan Omar, Minnesota, battleground state. You have Ocasio-Cortez, who has become the darling of the left-wing pro-socialist crowd, who hasn't even opened a congressional office in her district yet. The bottom line is they don't want people to see who they are. And that's a big reason why they don't want the State of the Union. When we come back, we're going to talk about why President Trump canceled the State of the Union, effectively bowing to Nancy Pelosi's pressure. Why didn't he do it in one of the battleground states, as we've been suggesting? We'll talk about that when the Battleground State News returns. This is BattlegroundStateNews.com. Go to BattlegroundStateNews.com on the web, and we'll be right back with more.
The Battleground State Report.
And welcome back in. I'm Steve Gill. Michael Patrick Leahy here with us, as well as Doug Kellett, breaking down the news around the country as we take a look towards 2020 and what impact these stories may have on the electoral results in the next presidential cycle. It's already begun. And the battle over President Trump's State of the Union, as we were pointing out in the last segment, isn't just about letting the president address the country. It's about the Democrats being afraid to let America see who's actually running the House now. And again, Tammy Bruce did a great piece at Washington Examiner. We've got it linked up on our Facebook page at Battleground State News on Facebook, battlegroundstatenews.com on the web. And each weekend, we're here with you with the Battleground State Report to break down some of these stories. The president basically capitulated to Nancy Pelosi's demands that there not be a State of the State in the House chamber. There was discussion about whether the president could do the State of the Union in the Senate chamber. He was invited, as we know, in North Carolina by the speaker there to maybe give his speech in the House chamber in North Carolina. Michigan, another battleground state, also made the suggestion. You had a Tea Party organization in Ohio also make the suggestion of doing it with a Tea Party organization. We had talked here and had suggested that perhaps the president look at going down to Texas or one of the border states, maybe have a rally in a big arena. He has decided not to do any of those things. As again, guys, I guess our advice, not worth a cup of coffee.
So, Doug, my question to you is, we always like to look at these national events as to what kind of local impact they will have in the battleground states. And so my question to you, does the president's capitulation here to Nancy Pelosi, at least temporarily capitulating on the State of the Union address, at the same time he's received invitations from several battleground states to deliver that State of the Union address in the battleground states. The North Carolina House of Representatives Speaker gave him an invite. The Speaker of the House of Representatives in Michigan gave him an invite. As Steve mentioned, Tom Zawistowski, the head of the We the People Convention Tea Party group in Ohio, gave him an invitation to deliver the address at the Ohio State Fairgrounds. Now that, you know, that's very populous. And then the St. Louis Tea Party Coalition's Bill Hennessy invited the president to deliver the address in Missouri. All these battleground state Trump supporters inviting President Trump to deliver the State of the Union address in their state. He decides not to do that. Does that help or hurt the president in the battleground states?
Yeah, I think it was a missed opportunity. I think probably you guys agree with me on that. I think the president's been good on making the right decision at the right time when it comes to making political advantage. But this time, I was surprised, first of all, at the fact that he, you know, did not do exactly what you were saying. There might have been some logistic issues in that. But, you know, you look at the president's tweet about deciding not to do this, and I think we all agree. We don't know about whether the size of his hands, but we know his ego is somewhat large. And I think because of that, it seemed to indicate to me, anyway, the way I read it, see if you guys agree, that he really wanted the opportunity to have that traditional speak before both houses of Congress and all the, you know, the Supreme Court and all the traditions. With that, he did not want to give up that opportunity, is what it looked to me like.
I think the decision not to do it from the Oval Office was a good one. That's not his best game.
He needs an audience, right? He really does.
He feeds off that energy.
He does.
I would, again, as long as they're not going to take our advice, I'll offer two more pieces. First, there are some news stories that he is apparently considering or has issued an invitation to bring the Covington Catholic school kids to the White House to meet with them. My recommendation is do that immediately. Get them to D.C. immediately and serve them Chick-fil-A just to make sure that you completely make the left's head explode. And then second, I think you could make an argument as one of his communications advisors that if you're not going to do the State of the Union in the way that we've suggested and go into a battleground state, do a border event rally to, again, drive the media attention, drive national attention to the border fight that is underway and whether we secure our border. He did that trip down to the border. I think, again, go into an Arizona, go into a Texas, and have a rally-type Trump event that will get that national attention. Again, bring attention right back to the fact that you're trying to fight for security of the border, securing America, and the left does not want that to happen. And then you get another bite of the apple when you get a State of the Union.
I think it's a great idea, Steve, but I think the decision that the president made earlier this week, you know, just hours after he said he was considering alternatives, not to consider an alternative, hurts him with his base in battleground states. That it's a bad political move, I think, that his base was eager to support him. And his basically saying, I'm not going to do this, is a disappointment. And he loses leverage with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, who's actually not moving at all on the border wall shutdown, loses leverages big time. I think it would have been extremely powerful, in my view, if he had picked one of these battleground states, North Carolina, Michigan, Ohio, Missouri, probably either North Carolina or Ohio would have been the best, let's say, to deliver the State of the Union, simultaneously complying with the Constitution by delivering the written report, which the Constitution requires, he delivered to the Congress from time to time, deliver that, and then deliver the State of the Union address to the people, and break precedent and take the initiative. I think that would have buoyed support for the border wall and his position on the shutdown. It's a missed opportunity, but again, it's President Trump. You know, what time is it today? And could he change his mind in the next hour? He sure could.
That's true. I mean, I think a lot of us are still waiting for the art of the deal guy, right? I mean, been expecting, you know, the president to make some of these deals. I don't think his base is really going to run from him because he, you know, decided not to do the State of the Union at this time. But I do think it may be indicative, right? It may be his mindset. Is that what you're saying, Mike? That, you know, he may be, that Nancy Pelosi may be getting some leverage on him?
At the same time, though, you're seeing some cracks in the veneer on the Democratic side where some Democrats are starting to say, just give him the money and let's reopen the government. So both sides are poised to blink. And you've got, you know, Lindsey Graham now saying, I think that if we'll reopen the government, we can reach a deal in 3 weeks. Yeah, I don't buy that. I mean, the Democrats have not been willing to negotiate up until now. And now that suddenly they're going to start acting reasonably and rationally and fairly if you reopen the government, I don't see that happening. The bottom line is that this is a battle that the president, I think, is winning in the battleground states in terms of public opinion. He's, you know, the media keeps putting out these national opinion polls. And yet, when you look in the battleground states where people are seeing, you know, stories of rape and murder and drug deaths caused by those that are bringing illegal aliens across the border, subjecting more Americans to the terrors of drug abuse that with the fentanyl and everything else that's coming across the border, I think it is playing in terms of educating the public. But again, when you miss the opportunities to get that message over the heads of the media, I think it's a real missed opportunity. I think the president has missed the opportunity up until now.
But yeah, and the good news is it's President Donald Trump. The winds change with less frequency than his mind changes sometimes. And so there's always another act here with President Trump. That might be, you know, declaring a national emergency to build the wall. There may be something up. I'd like to see what it is.
I want a down payment. It's like, you know, we're not doing a real estate deal, Donald. I mean, we're not just looking for 10% down.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how this all plays out. I do think he's taken a step backwards with momentum by caving to Nancy Pelosi on the State of the Union. We talked about this before. I think one of the reasons has been that you notice, by the way, Doug, that a Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, during all this, he didn't step up and say, oh, Mr. President, come on over here to the Senate chamber and deliver the State of the Union. He, who controls the chamber, did not say that, even though Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee, Senator Rand Paul, Kentucky, they suggested that. Senator Mitch McConnell, who has the authority, did not make that offer.
I think that was good. I mean, that you point that out because, you know, I've been wondering about Mitch in this whole process. We haven't heard much from him, right? I'm not sure he's as happy about the shutdown and everything that's been connected with it, I think.
I do think that, again, the more America sees of Nancy Pelosi, the better it is for Donald Trump. As we've pointed out before, Hillary Clinton was the only person that could lose to Donald Trump. Donald Trump could only beat Hillary Clinton. I mean, Nancy Pelosi being your foil is good for Trump, especially when she's out there worrying about furloughed employees wearing a $1,500 Hermes scarf.
Another reason why she should have given a response in D.C. to a State of the Union delivered in a battleground state.
Might have been a good idea. We'll be back with more of the Battleground State Report in just a moment.
Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellen.
And welcome in for our final segment today. If you've ever been to the circus, you know, I always like it when they bring out the clown car and then, like, you know, just dozens and dozens of clowns just keep piling out of the car and you wonder how did they fit them all in and what other, you know, clown is going to climb out next. That's kind of how we're seeing things with the presidential announcements from the Democratic Party. I think we're up to about 7 or 8 people have announced that they're running for president of the United States. You've got some that have a little bit of visibility and name recognition. Kamala Harris, a senator from California. You have others that are not very well known at all. For example, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, whose claim to fame is that he's openly gay and married to a man, is running for president of the United States as a Democrat. You're going to have 30 maybe different candidates decide to announce they're starting to go to places like Iowa and New Hampshire and start to get the national media to talk about them. Elizabeth Warren has been to Iowa. Kamala Harris, I think, is going to Iowa this weekend. You've got Joe Biden being mentioned. Bernie Sanders, you know, he's like 182 years old, but he's still willing to climb out of the clown car. It is a cast of characters that will divide the vote, and it is, as somebody has pointed out, it's kind of like Lord of the Flies. Who survives?
Yeah, and not only that, so all these Democratic presidential contenders are announcing, and now the national polls are out. There's a recent national poll that was up at the Hill earlier this week, and it shows that the top five contenders nationally, number one, Joe Biden, he's not announced yet. He's supposedly going to make an announcement shortly. Number two, Bernie Sanders. He's not announced yet. Number three, with 9% of the vote of the Democratic nationally primary voters, Kamala Harris from California. We'll talk about her in a second. She has announced. Number four, Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas, has announced. She's in fourth, 6% tied with.
Has she already announced Nathan Phillips, the fake Vietnam veteran Native American, as her running mate?
I think that would be a great, that's the perfect great team.
By the way, I just sent you a picture of the two of them.
I saw that picture.
Yeah, okay, you ought to check it out. Birds of a feather, my
friend. It is funny. So in fourth place, tied with Elizabeth Warren, is former Representative Francis Beto O'Rourke from Texas. Now, you would think, what do you think of a name? If somebody's called Beto O'Rourke, what do you think their heritage is?
Maybe Italian or
Hispanic.
Hispanic?
Yeah, yeah. From what we can tell, Irish, Welsh, there's not a bit of Hispanic.
So we've got a fake heritage. Indian in Elizabeth Warren, a fake Hispanic in Beto O'Rourke. I mean, it's just the list goes on.
He's not made any claims to heritage. It's just that he's...
It's nuanced.
It's nuanced. He's using a nickname that suggests... He's Hispanic.
He has, however, tried to grab the clean teeth lovers by live casting his teeth cleaning.
Very informative, Steve. I can't believe you continue to pick on the fact that he broadcast live or Facebook or whatever his teeth cleaning down at the dentist.
I'm just praying he doesn't go in for a prostate exam over there.
Or
colonoscopy. By the way, I want to thank you for that sort of nostalgic circus reference here. Since the Democrats, maybe this is why. Since you say they're like a circus, they put the circus out of business.
Yeah,
maybe that's
exactly.
The reason, right?
So here's the...
They've done that with coal miners. They've done that with millions of Americans as well. So putting people out of work really is the Democratic social economic policy.
Reverse economics, yes.
So the interesting thing about this national poll and Kamala Harris, who's now in third place and is a photogenic, shall we say, she's an interesting background. Her father is Jamaican. Her mother's Indian.
Yeah, some people are not Native American India.
Yeah.
Some people are raising the question in the African American community: is she black enough to run as the black candidate? You've still got Cory Spartacus Booker up in New Jersey, who's still on the sidelines trying to decide whether to run or not. Interestingly, and we'll post this up at Battleground State News on Facebook. There's a great story out that details kind of a hidden asset that Kamala Harris has, and that's her sorority membership. In the black community, particularly for women, there is a powerful political undercurrent. It certainly plays in local politics, and Kamala Harris is going to use this as an operation to play nationally. She was a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority at Howard University. That is basically a political, business, social connection operation that I think most white Americans aren't aware of how impactful that is for someone in the black community to get the credibility, to have that ground troop force in place. And a great news story detailing that and how Kamala Harris is going to count on that sorority connection to give her kind of a hidden grassroots base throughout the country. And do not think that this is not an extraordinarily powerful asset for her.
Yeah, it is. And by the way, so it's interesting about Harris. She's photogenic. She's got that sorority. She's far left. She's young. These are all pluses. She's clearly a strident far left ideologue from her vicious and unwarranted attacks on Brett Kavanaugh during the Senate confirmation hearings. She also knows very little about Flyover America, or the heartland of America. She grew up in high school. She was in Canada from age 12 to age 18. She went to high school in Canada, in Montreal. And so she doesn't really connect with mainstream America. I think what's very interesting about Kamala Harris, I think she would be relatively easy for President Trump to beat. And I'll tell you why. She shows up in this national poll in third place of Democrats with 9% of the vote. She's from California. That's not a battleground state. And, you know, President Trump lost to Hillary Clinton 60-30. It's entirely possible that Kamala Harris could win California, you know, 70-25 or even 75-20. And I think most of her support in this national poll comes from California. That's irrelevant for a national candidate on the Democratic ticket in terms of winning the presidency in these 17 battleground states. So she's going to be overinflated in terms of these national polls, and she's going to overperform in California and, I think, underperform in the battleground states. Doug, what say you?
Yeah, you know all the, you know, the details and vote counting and all that. I really have no idea. I would just say this, that while she does have these extreme views, she's, you know, she comes from being the attorney general in California, so she can plug into the idea that she's some kind of law enforcement candidate. But I would say that she doesn't come off as the scary sort of liberal that we see, right? I see her almost like an African American female version of Barack Obama. That a lot of people could they see the individual, but they don't really listen to what their views are. Could be wrong about that. I did read a story this week that a lot of the Hillary Clinton, you know, sort of politicos are kind of lining up with her. That she's encouraging them to join, is why she came out as early as she did. And while they certainly didn't win for Hillary, because you had Hillary as a candidate, these are people who have long track record of working in Democrat campaigns. So that could be an advantage, maybe.
She has a lot of energy. Again, she's telegenic. She's certainly a good communicator. I think you're right. She, you know, for the Democrats, they see a female version of Barack Obama. I think the challenge that she faces is do you win back those voters in the Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, blue collar Democrat, Reagan Democrat class? And I think with the economy going where it is, if it continues with Trump being able to make the case that we don't need to go down the same path that has destroyed California and threatens to turn it into an American version of Venezuela, I think, again, you've got to frame the case well early and not just engage in kind of, you know, I'm not Hillary, that really was a key factor in Donald Trump winning.
Aren't
I think
glad?
The I'm not Kamala doesn't work the same way.
Yeah, exactly. And Doug, you make a very good point that she is a female version of Barack Obama. In some regards, that's what she's pushing. And, you know, Barack Obama.
Well, I mean, Mike, no one ever really cared what Barack Obama thought about anything. I mean, you start going through the
issues,
he would lose on everything, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, people are like, I can't believe he's like that, right? And she's probably the same way, but yeah, they were not intimidated by the persona of Barack Obama.
I mean, Hillary Clinton was just unlikable.
Oh,
I think you've got some other Democrat candidates that may fall into that same category. She does not seem unlikable on the surface, and it'll be important for issues again, they didn't do an effective job because, you know, the Hillary Clinton campaign operation during the primary ignored and did not take Barack Obama seriously. So they didn't highlight his lack of experience, his lack of knowledge, his blank slate of a record. And the same thing's true with Kamala Harris. I think if you've got, you know, 20 or 30 Democrats all running, they're going to take shots at each other. They're going to cut each other up a lot more than Hillary Clinton faced in her primary. Again, at the end of the day, you had Bernie Sanders hurting her a bit. But you didn't have kind of a sustained onslaught of, you know, 20, 30 candidates all taking shots at the front runner. And Kamala Harris will be among the front runners that will be taking
Absolutely.
Shots.
Absolutely. And interesting enough, your point, Doug, you know, Barack Obama wasn't from a battleground state. He was from Illinois and was able to persuade battleground state, you know, independents that he wasn't, he was worth taking a risk on. Now, well, let's back to the strength of Kamala Harris. Contrast her with another blue state senator, Kirsten Gillibrand.
Has the female vote appeal, but doesn't apply to the, you know, have the same kind of demographic appeal that a Kamala Harris, if she's the front-running, quote, African-American, even though, again, Jamaican and Indian isn't necessarily African-American, but it's African-American enough for the identity politics of the left.
Yes.
That's going to play well in some of those early Democratic primary states of South Carolina and other states with large black populations, where if she carries a significant portion of the black vote in the Democratic primary, you know, it may be difficult unless you have other strong African-American candidates that are running. It may be hard for these other candidates to pull back those votes.
And back to the likability factor, okay?
Exactly. So, that's it right there, isn't it? Between Kamala and Gillibrand? There's more likability on Kamala's favor?
By a long shot. But
also, you've got Tulsi Gabbard out there. I mean, that massive Hawaiian-American vote that's going to demographically support her.
But Tulsi Gabbard.
Wait a minute. It worked for Obama. I mean, I keep bringing Obama up. I can't believe you guys are forcing me to do that. All I can say is I am happy that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez cannot run. She's not eligible because 70% of Democrats said they would vote for her for president.
Well, here's the interesting angle on this. Back to the likability thing that you guys brought up, which is totally correct here. So we've got a situation where, you know, Gillibrand is not actually that likable. And she's gone to, when she went to Iowa, she landed like a thud. I mean, she wore the jeans. She's not a jeans-wearing person. She's programmed like Hillary Clinton is. She has the other problem of having
reversed. At least she didn't wear the muumuu like Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
She did make that good fashion choice.
At least.
Or get me a beer like Elizabeth Warren. Well, that one still bothers me. You know? Get me a beer.
You're totally right about that. But in Gillibrand's cases, she totally flipped. She was a conservative pro-Second Amendment person running for Congress. In the Senate, she's flipped. At least Kamala Harris has been consistently far left throughout her career. The other problem is
I think the official shoe of the Democratic Party is the flip-flop.
Exactly.
So I don't know that they're really that concerned about that.
Elizabeth Warren is not likable. She's like Hillary Clinton. Gillibrand is not likable. Kamala Harris is likable, and that may be the story going forward in Iowa.
Beto's likable. I mean, that's what he ran on the charisma campaign. And again, you're going to see who's got the charisma, who's got the money. And again, Kamala Harris out of California can raise the money.
As Steve Gill said last week, it's an example of the Kardashianization of American culture and politics.
And we're going to see it awash with the Democrats running for president of the United States. We will be back again next weekend. In the meantime, go to battlegroundstatenews.com. It's battlegroundstatenews.com. Also, Battleground State News on Facebook. And we'll be back here same time, same bat channel, next weekend to break down what will, again, be a huge week of news affecting presidential politics, even before the race has officially begun. You have a great rest of the week.